So you're one of the 12 disciples, and after that tremendous incident on the Lake Galilee, that storm that you've just been caught up in, you feel rather exhausted, and you, like Jesus did a moment ago, find the need to rest your head on the pillow and get some kip in the stern of the boat. And a little while later, you're awoken by a noise. At first, you thought it was one of the disciples calling you, but it's not. And when you wake up, you see that all the other disciples are looking intently at the shore. And as your eyes adjust from the sleep, there you see on the grassy banks of Lake Galilee the occasional brown dot. And your boat drifts a bit closer, and you find out they're pigs. Not just one or two pigs, but not just 10 or 20, but thousands and thousands of pigs spread out in a great big herd across the shoreline. And instantly your Jewish gut instincts respond, and you think unclean, and you feel a little stab of revulsion at the sheer number of pigs on the shoreline. But then, before you're able to process that thought, you hear that sound again, and it's louder and sharper than it was before. And the closer you get to the shore, the louder that sound becomes. And it sounds too human to be one of the pigs. It's like someone crying out loud, like screams. And at this point you're thinking, well, maybe we should sort of move back from the shore a little bit. But Jesus seems intent on landing the boat. And then you look up and you see these dark halls opening in the shoreline, up on the banks. And you see that they're tombs. And now you can hear that the screams are coming from those tombs, echoing within them and going out across the lake. And it's the screams of men. And then the boat pulls up on the shoreline. Now you're really thinking we should definitely turn back. But one by one, you all put on a brave face and step out of the boat onto the shore. And privately, you're thinking to yourself, I hope we're not here for too long. And all of a sudden then, a figure emerges in the tomb entrance, way up on the hill. And he looks wild and he looks angry. And you hope he hasn't seen you. But then it turns out he has, because he starts tearing down the bank towards you. And he's naked. And his skin is black and blue and red. And Jesus starts crying out loud to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." But the man doesn't stop running. He runs all the way down to the shoreline. And you all draw back behind Jesus in fear. It's a terrifying, disturbing sight. This man is a threat. And he threatens contamination, he threatens captivity, and he threatens chaos. Three threats, all of which are dealt by Jesus in this passage. And so I want us to consider those three threats this evening: contamination, captivity, and chaos. And I want us to see what we can learn about the one, Jesus Christ, who resolves this threatening situation. So firstly, let's consider Jesus and the threat of contamination. Jesus and the threat of contamination. When you tell the story in the way that I've just done, the passage begins to look a bit like a scene from a science fiction film. The spacecraft has just left its home planet. It's voyaged across dangerous asteroid fields. And then finally it lands on this strange, unpredictable, alien planet. Anything could happen next. And so too then, Jesus and his crew have left the familiar region of Capernaum. They've passed through their storm on the lake, and now their boat arrives on this other side of the sea, these strange, alien, unpredictable shores. In fact, strange and alien are precisely the right words, given the way that our Bible uses those words, to refer to the non-Jewish Gentile world. There's some debate about where the country of the Gerasenes is, mentioned in verse 1 there. But given what we do know from archaeological evidence, and of course factoring in the fact that you've got this vast number of pigs, it seems beyond question that this place was something of a Gentile stronghold. The disciples are stepping into a Gentile world, literally a world of strangers and aliens. And to fully grasp the significance of what's happening in our passage, I think it's worth stepping back for a moment and reminding ourselves of God's role for Israel in the presence of a strange and alien world. You see, when we speak of Israel as a light to the nations, that's quite right. We're right to use that language. That's biblical. But we mustn't forget that as well as being a light to the nations, Israel was also a place of isolation from the nations, a sort of safe zone, a sort of reverse quarantine, if I could put it like that. Not that they had a disease which had to be contained and the nations to be protected from, but rather that the nations, the rest of the world, had a disease which Israel had to be protected from. And much Old Testament literature, and particularly the law, is about establishing and maintaining that state of reverse quarantine. Let's consider this for just a moment. I want to consider that whole legal system that we find outlined in Exodus to Deuteronomy, which is supposed to govern the way Israel is run. That whole legal system could be said to be all about boundaries, lines of demarcation, not just between Israel and the world, but also lines of demarcation within Israel, drawing out lines that separated, for instance, sacred from common, clean from unclean. And those lines reached right down into what you could eat, what you could wear, what you could or couldn't touch, whether you lived outside the camp or in the camp, what boundaries within the temple you could access, who you could marry, who you couldn't marry. Boundaries were everywhere. Often those things and those circumstances which were considered themselves unclean were themselves transgressing certain category distinctions, certain barriers. So, for instance, any movement from the realm of the dead to the living, that risked contamination. To touch a corpse left you unclean for several days. Anything that transgressed biological barriers carried risks. Skin diseases or the loss of bodily fluid, all that was associated with uncleanness. Or the boundaries that applied to food. If an animal chewed the cud and had a cloven hoof, then it was considered to be in a safe, distinct category of livestock, and you could eat of that animal. But not all animals were like that. Not all animals were clean in that respect. Like pigs, for instance. Leviticus chapter 11, verse 7 says, "And the pig, because it parts the hoof and is cloven-footed but does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. You shall not eat of their flesh and you shall not touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you." They transgressed certain barriers. They weren't safely within that category distinction. The same goes for fish. If they swam in the river and had fins and scales, they were fair game. You could eat them. But if, however, they swam in the river but didn't have fins and scales, then according to the symbolic world of Leviticus, that was a detestable hybrid that sort of straddled the boundaries between one category and another, and therefore it was unclean and it couldn't be eaten. So Israelite society then was this bubble of ritual cleanliness that could only be maintained through careful adherence to these boundaries in a world full of uncleanness. And of course, that symbolic uncleanliness spoke of a deeper spiritual reality. Symbols were important in a world where cultural practices were enmeshed with genuine evil practices, cult prostitution, or bestiality, or child sacrifices. And so it was crucial then that Israel had their own symbols and established their own cultural practices in opposition to those of the Gentile world in which they lived. And for that reason then, Israel was a fragile bubble. It risked being infringed upon. It risked being contaminated by a Gentile disease. We considered that briefly this morning, didn't we? The possibility of Israel taking on Gentile practices incrementally, bit by bit, compromising. So why am I explaining all of this to you now? Well, I'm explaining it to you because there is no mistaking the threat of uncleanness, of contamination, that is posed to Jesus and his 12 Jewish disciples when they get off this boat in this Gentile region. I mean, not only are they setting foot on unclean Gentile turf, so to speak, not only are the hills swarming with these alien, hybrid, revolting creatures, pigs, twisted and ugly, evoking a response of horror and shame and uncleanness to these disciples. But on top of that, now comes this naked Gentile man, quite visibly uncircumcised and covered in bruises and leaking blood and saliva and bodily fluid, and emerging from this seat of uncleanness itself, out of the tombs, the place of the dead, surrounded by corpses. And if, on top of that, the very spirits that possess him are described as unclean in verse 2. And so immediately then, this man meets the disciples with an unclean spirit, and so unclean on so many levels. He is a religious biohazard. He carries the threat of contamination. In the book of Isaiah in chapter 65, God describes what happens when those Israelite boundaries are not maintained. He describes the end game of Israelite-Gentile cross-contamination, where the distinctions are no longer kept. He speaks of Israel becoming a place full of people, 65 verse 4, who sit in tombs and spend the night in secret places, who eat pig's flesh, and broth of tainted meat is in their vessels. It's a curiously apt picture of contamination, considering what we read in our passage. And that was the ugly fate then, which charges downhill towards these 12 men in this passage, this threat of uncleanness. And this then is why it's so important for us to see what happens at this point in the story. Because actually what happens at this point in the story flies in the face of all our expectations. You see, were we to operate only according to the principles found in the Old Testament law, we might think that Jesus at this point was allowing for a breach in the bubble, that he was inviting contamination to come pouring in, that the dirty godlessness of the Gentile realm was on its way to spoiling the white sheet of the Messiah. But astonishingly, what happens is the very reverse. The unclean becomes clean. The twisted, unclean spirits retreat to the twisted, unclean pigs, which promptly find themselves washed off the banks. Not one seems to be left behind on the shore. And as those disciples then stand there looking at that horrible mass of thousands of dirty, squealing pigs tearing down the bank, they must find themselves thinking, all of that just came out of this one man. That's what was inside of him. This relentless, loud, stampeding mass of demonic uncleanness. And that mass then being cast into that water is a mighty depiction of this cleaning act which takes place now in this man. The man does not contaminate Jesus with ritual uncleanness, but rather the purity of Christ drives out his uncleanness and restores him to a state of purity. Indeed, it seems that the reason the man is left behind by Jesus at the end of this passage. He begs to be with Jesus, of course, but Jesus, almost confusingly to our eyes, doesn't permit him. It seems like the reason he doesn't permit him is because he wishes this man to continue that cleaning process in the middle of a Gentile world, to bring the good news of the cleansing power of Jesus to the Gentiles. It's funny, really, isn't it? Because you'd think he was the last person to be equipped to do that. He was once over one of the filthiest, both ritually and morally. And yet now he is the very tool by which the Gentiles will find out about the cleansing work of Christ. He's like a tiny capsule of washing powder thrown into a washing machine of dirty clothes. So no, he does not go with Jesus back onto the boat, though he begs that he would. But rather, Jesus does go with him as good news to the Gentiles. Now, I speak to a room of Gentiles this evening, and we must remember this fact. If we're wanting to locate ourselves in this passage, well, we're the strangers and the aliens. That's what Paul says to his Greek readers, isn't it? Paul says, remember that you at that time were separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. Remember, he says, remember, you were once unclean. We need to recognize this evening that we were once on the outside of that great perimeter fence that spanned Israel. We were once unclean. Not that we just enjoyed eating pork, but rather we were spiritually sick and contaminated and unclean and in the dark. And yet here what we see is Jesus leaving that perimeter fence. Why? To come and get you, to enter that exclusion zone, that danger area, to bring cleansing to strangers and aliens. The blessings of the bubble of Israel come out and bring us in. And so we are redeemed from our status as aliens, and the moral uncleanness is totally healed. So that's Jesus and the threat of contamination. Secondly, this evening, I want us to look at Jesus and the threat of captivity. Jesus and the threat of captivity. The fact that the man who's charging down the hillside is the same man who in verse 3 and 4 has burst his shackles on numerous occasions. He's wrenched his chains apart and broke the shackles in pieces. It tells us in verses 3 and 4. Well, that's something intimidating, isn't it, for the disciples? This is a man who cannot be easily taken captive. He resists all captivity, so it seems. Except that's not quite right, is it? Because actually what makes this man even more intimidating than that is that in a deeper sense, he is shackled. He is a victim. He is a captive. At the beginning of the film Gladiator, there's a scene where a Roman diplomat is returning on horseback, having met with barbarian tribes. And only as the horse arrives back in the ranks of the Roman army, you see that on its back is not the diplomat, but rather the dead body of the diplomat strapped to the back of the horse. The barbarians had sent him back dead. It was an intimidating show of power, which really happened in the ancient world. A show of power from the enemy. Just look at what we did to your diplomat. And then sure enough, the barbarians come out of the forest and they're waving their swords and beating their shields and crying out. And as this man tears down the hillside in our passage, wailing and covered in self-inflicted scars, he does so as a poor victim. And to some extent, I think it is a show of force from his real captors, his demons. Just look at what we've done to this man. I think probably we see something of this power play throughout the passage. The demons using intimidation tactics, trying to get the upper hand on Jesus. I mean, for instance, three times in Mark's Gospel, we've witnessed the demons naming Jesus. The demon in the synagogue in chapter 1 says, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. The demons in chapter 3 in verse 11 say, you are the Son of God. And the demon in our passage in verse 7 says, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God, naming Jesus almost as if by using his name, the demons are trying to exert some dominance over him, maybe trying to unmask him in an intimidating way. It also seems to have been a common idea in the ancient world that by naming something, you were expressing some level of dominance over that thing. So, for example, by naming a demon, you were able to exercise it because you're expressing dominance over it. Well, perhaps the reverse is happening in this passage. The demons are trying to do that very thing to Jesus by naming him. Also, notice how the demons use that phrase, I adjure you by God, in verse 7. Swear to God, they're saying to him. It's a command, they're imploring him, grasping onto some impression of authority. And then, of course, most frighteningly of all, we have this intimidating self-description of the demons, this use of military language. My name is Legion, for we are many. It's like those barbarians waving their swords. And yet, in spite of all that, It's the demons themselves who, by their own behaviour, show where the power really lies in this passage. Because as much as they might like to threaten Jesus and his men with this threat of captivity, even their show of power is fraught with vulnerability and insecurity. "What have you to do with me?" is the first words we hear this demon speak, and yet you can almost hear the tremble in their voice as they utter them. And then when they do adjure Jesus by God, swear to God, they say to him, when they do that, however big and clever they thought they were being at the first half of that sentence, by the second half of the sentence, they're pleading pathetically, "I adjure you by God, do not torment me." And in the end then, this whole scene looks rather cartoonish for the demons, like someone threatening a lion with a water pistol, all the while sort of backing off with their knees knocking and their teeth chattering, because ultimately the demons are outmatched. What is it exactly that they're afraid of? Well, here they beg Jesus not to send them out of the country, verse 10. In Luke's gospel, they're pleading with Jesus not to be sent into what they call the abyss. Whatever it is that they're afraid of here, it seems to be that the bottom line is they realize that Jesus has the power to banish them and torment them. That's what they're frightened of. They're worried that Jesus will torment them in verse 7. Usually it's demons who do the tormenting, but now they're worried about Jesus tormenting them. Jesus the tormentor, it's not a phrase you hear very often, but it's a real fear for these demons. And so then, as a better alternative, they beg to be cast into the pigs. But you can't help but wonder when you witness that even that end of the demon seems to be a very foretaste of the torment they're so desperate to avoid. It seems to me that these demons end up receiving, if not the fate itself, then at least a big picture of the fate that they're so desperate to defer. To be enclosed within those fat, ugly pigs, only to be swallowed up by a watery grave, just like the Egyptians were thousands of years beforehand. Is that not itself a picture of God's ultimate judgment upon them? Jesus banishes and, in some sense, judges these captors. And I think today we should be very thankful that occasionally the Bible does peel back the wallpaper of ordinary life and show us the dramatic spiritual backdrop which lies behind it. You know, it's so easy for us to think that our biggest enemies, our biggest slave drivers, are our stubborn employers or our godless political leaders or corrupt billionaires and their corporations. But once again, we need to look behind all of that and see the real enemies. It's interesting how these demons call themselves legion. You know, there were disciples on that boat who were perhaps still under the impression that Jesus was there to liberate them from the legions of Romans. Like the Egyptians, the Romans and their military would be cast into the sea. And Jesus could do that. Jesus could swamp the Romans. He tells us elsewhere that he has at his disposal more than 12 leagues of angels. He could bring the whole Roman Empire to dust. That's no big deal for Jesus. And even today, Jesus could swamp the nations and the tyrants of this world in a moment. And indeed, there was a day when all of creation was swamped, when the flood itself wiped out almost everyone on this planet. And yet, that flood should be a lesson to us, because even that judgment did nothing to save the creation from its true captors. Even that judgment left the greatest of our enemies unscathed. And so, were Jesus to have drowned the Romans, or the barbarians, or the Normans, or the Mongols, or the Nazis, just under the skin of the world would remain the real enemy lurking underneath. You see, behind this world, there is an invisible world of demons, legion upon legion, a vast military force to whom all other wicked military forces are bound. And without Christ, we too are their captives. That might be a fact that should scare you this evening. It's a terrifying thing. Don't think that Vladimir Putin is your worst enemy. He's not. There is a much scarier force at work in this world. And yet, if Christ is your saviour this evening, then you too need to hear the good news of this passage, where Christ reveals himself as the great destroyer of those demons and the liberator of their captives. And as you've no doubt heard preached again and again, while we still wait for the final destruction of all our enemies and the overcoming of all evil, the victory over them is sealed already, because the judge's hammer has fallen. The Son of God has come into the world and he has completed his devil-destroying mission. As we speak, the demon pigs are already tearing down the banks and heading towards their watery doom. And if only you can grasp that fact this evening, then I put it to you that that fact alone can transform whatever genuine oppression you're facing in your life right now. Because it means you face that oppression with the certain knowledge that you are already liberated. Your captives have already been overcome, and in Christ you are set free. He has dealt with the threat of captivity. Hold on to that fact. See the blessing of it. Know that any oppression that you face today is nothing compared to that which you have been liberated from already. And even that will be overcome. So we've seen Jesus and the threat of contamination, Jesus and the threat of captivity. But thirdly, and more briefly, Jesus and the threat of chaos. Jesus and the threat of chaos. See, it shouldn't go unnoticed that the demon-possessed man that these disciples meet in this passage, this man possesses qualities which are not too different from the qualities of the storm these disciples have just experienced on the lake. In chapter 5, verses 35 to 41, the disciples had experienced this untamed creation, this wild storm. Jesus had rebuked it as if it were a person, and then brought it into a peace, into a place of peace and serenity. And order had reigned over chaos in that situation. But now the disciples, they really witness the same miracle again, but the chaos is no longer on the outside, but rather it's on the inside in this poor man, because he too is in a wild state. He too is in a self-destructive state. He is naked. He's bruising himself with stones. He's in this chaotic state, tearing at his chains and letting out screams and neurons firing madly in his brain and his emotions swirling about him. And he too is sort of straddling the world of the living and the dead, like those pigs we mentioned before, straddling sort of category distinctions, not just in an unclean sense, but also in that sense of breaking rules, being chaotic in nature. So chaos then, it was frightening enough on that lake, but now the disciples are facing it again in this man. And yet, Jesus deals with this man. And these disciples once again witness chaos being reined in. And when we see this man again in verses 15 and 16, he's not naked anymore. He's clothed. He's sitting peacefully and with self-restraint at Jesus' feet. And most significantly, we're told that he's in his right mind. And then in verse 19, he's instructed to take his place back in society, to return to his home, to his friends — it's assumed he has friends — to be restored to his relationships with them, and then to speak of this peace of Jesus Christ. Again, chaos brought into order. Now, as we've moved through the pages of Mark's Gospel, we've not yet encountered anything like a clear, comprehensive statement about who Jesus is or what he is here to do. Certainly Jesus hasn't made any explicit statement of that kind yet, but what we have seen is that with every passing incident that occurs in this gospel, every miracle that takes place, something new seems to be revealed about Jesus' identity. Another dimension is added. Layer upon layer, we find ourselves understanding more about who this man is. And in particular, these last two miracles, this calming of the storm and this healing of the demon-possessed man, well, I think they leave an imprint on the observers that goes beyond the kind of local excitement and amazement that we've witnessed already in this book. I think we see something different here in the response these miracles receive. Because what was the response of the disciples when they saw that storm being reined in? Well, verse 41 of chapter 4 says, "And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" It was fear. And what's the response of the locals when peaceful order is restored to this chaotic man? Well, verse 15 again tells us that they were afraid. They were afraid. And I think the core of this fear is the same in both cases. Because as we demonstrated last time, this calming of the chaos can be nothing other than the power of God. And I think the same can be said for everything that we've seen in this passage so far, because it's only by the power of God that unclean can be declared clean. Under Old Testament law, the man would have contaminated Jesus with ritual impurity, but that doesn't happen. He purifies him. Only God can do that. Only God's chosen Messiah, by the power of God, is the one who can release captives from the devil and crush the devil and the demons. And I think this is the conclusion that Mark finds himself drawn to take us to at the end of this passage. Notice how in verse 19, Jesus says to the man, "Tell them how much the Lord has done for you," using that word which was used to refer to God in the Old Testament. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you, surely referring to God. And yet in the very next verse, Mark tells us that the man proclaims how much Jesus had done for him. The point being, I think, that there's no essential difference between those two statements. Why? Because Jesus is Lord, and the Lord is Jesus. And in light of all that, I would just say this, that you might be listening to this sermon this evening, and you might be taking it all in, and you might be following my basic points, but you still can't bring yourself to believe this book. You can't dedicate yourself to this man in this passage. You still have to remain a skeptic. And I would just ask you to consider honestly, really, can you not trust this man? Will you not trust this man? After all that you've seen here, after all that you know of him, after all that you've witnessed in this passage, even after this great display of goodness and power. Okay, so you claim that it's all made up, that it's just exaggerated tales by his swooning followers. But I would say to you that aside from the historical facts, which just make that idea absurd, surely you must agree that at the very least, the portrayal of this man we find in this gospel is so beautiful and so lovely and so impressive and so in keeping with the Old Testament scriptures he claims to fulfill. And just so downright glorious that were it made up by a group of first century fishermen, then those fishermen would have had to have been the greatest intellects and the greatest artists and storytellers the world had ever seen. I guess what I'm saying is, the moment you take this book seriously and you give it some serious thought, the moment you too have to crumble fearfully at the feet of this man, Jesus. There are several times in this passage that Mark uses the word beg. The demons beg Jesus not to beg Jesus that they wouldn't be cast out of the country, and that they beg Jesus that they would be cast into the pigs in verse 12. And then again, the locals beg Jesus to depart from the region, such is their fear of him in verse 17. And then finally, this man begs to be with Jesus in verse 18. And again, I would just say to you, look, whether like the demons and like these locals, you want nothing to do with Jesus. You want him just to leave you alone like these people did. And actually, the tragedy is that if you do desperately want that, you might get your way. But whether that's the case, at least admit that whatever path you take here, in the presence of this man, you have to be begging. Such is his power and goodness and glory. You are reduced to begging. And my hope and prayer then is that rather than begging for his departure, you may be more like the demon-possessed man in this passage, and that you too would beg for his company. And I really believe that if you beg for that, you will get it. And while that might mean just returning to an ordinary Gentile, 21st century lifestyle with all of its regular hardships. Nonetheless, you will do that, being able to tell your friends how much the Lord has done for you and how much he has had mercy on you. That's what we read of this man in verses 19 and 20. So that is my encouragement to you this evening. Really, you cannot resist this man. His display of power and goodness is irresistible. You have to beg before him. Please beg that you might be with him, not that you might depart from him. Amen.